He turned off the motor. Where else can you two superstars go tonight? One of you has been drinking all day, all life, and the other one's as jittery as a talking doll in the hands of a small boy. Fletcher, you're something else.
I know that. What else is the question?
He got out and opened the car's trunk. She followed him behind the car. What's that? She asked.
A picnic basket. Had it made up while I was looking for Freddy. Lots of goodies. Chopped ham and pickle, shrimp, champagne.
He took the hamper out and slammed the trunk's lid. He opened the back door of the car. Mr. Mooney? He shook Mooney's arm. The bottle in Mooney's lap was almost empty.
We're at the airport, sir.
Mooney blinked at him.
Thought we'd get high for dinner, sir.
Very thoughtful of you.
Mooney began to climb out of the car.
Very thoughtful indeed, Mr. Peterman.
Chapter 8.
I don't see the moon, Moxie said.
Complaints. Have to be patient. Fletch was pouring champagne into long-stemmed glasses.
A little bubbly, Mr. Mooney?
Never touch the stuff, Mooney said. Upsets my cognac.
They were sitting in large leather swivel chairs. Each had a safety belt strapped across the lap. The passenger section of the airplane was furnished and decorated partly as a living room, partly as an office. At first, the pilot who had escorted them across the dark runway had watched worriedly Frederick Mooney's stumbling gait. It did not make him less worried that Frederick Mooney was singing, very loudly and very badly, "If I Had the Wings of an Angel." As they were passing under a light, the pilot's face did a double look and expressed shock at recognizing Moxie Mooney. He looked sharply and recognized Frederick Mooney. Solicitously, he helped Frederick Mooney up the steps and strapped him into the seat himself. The plane took off immediately.
"I presume we're to fly in circles," Moxie said.
"How on earth can you fly any other way?" Fletch asked.
Seated, Fletch was setting the pull-out table within easy reach of their chairs with things from the picnic basket. He removed the protective cellophane from the plates of cut, assorted sandwiches, opened the containers of iced shrimp, lobster tails, their sauces, salads, dealt plates and cutlery and napkins around the table. Last out of the basket was a little white vase and a long-stemmed red rose. He poured champagne into the vase, put the rose in it, and set the rose in the middle of the table. Watching him, Moxie said,
"You would make an interesting husband after all."
"I did," Fletch said, "twice."
"As the lady said,"
intoned Frederick Mooney with a cold look at his daughter.
"Just as they were leading her away, I was cursed by marriage to an interesting man."
Fletch looked from one to another, then said, "Anyone for eats?" Both Moonies wordlessly heaped their plates with every food in sight.
"Enough for the vanity of film stars," Fletch muttered, helping himself from the remainders. "Good thing I bought for six."
Plate in lap, Mooney swiveled his chair to look out the window while he ate. "Now," Fletch said to Moxie after she had downed 6 quarter sandwiches, 4 lobster tails, and 1/2 her shrimp.
"Want to tell me why you asked me to come down here? Or have you had enough for today? Or maybe it isn't relevant anymore."
"You're hard enough to find," grumbled Moxie. "It took me the better part of a week to trace you down."
"I was in Washington," Fletch said, "trying to find the Bureau of Indian Affairs."
"Did you find it?" She was chewing a lobster tail. "I narrowed it down to one of 3 telephone booths. She wiped her hands on a napkin. "I seem to be in real financial trouble."
"How is that possible?"
"You tell me."
"Some nights you're on 2 television channels simultaneously. You're on the cables so much, I should think you'd twang. Your films play the theaters. Last Christmas you did the first 100 days of a Broadway hit."
"And I'm drowning in debt. Explain that to me."
"I'd like to understand it myself. You're smudging the American dream, the rich and famous dream."
There were tears in her eyes. She ducked her head to her plate.
"I work hard. I have to. So many people are counting on me. My work contributes to the income of literally thousands of people now. We've got my mother in this fabulously expensive sanatorium in Kansas. I've taken over some of the cost from Freddie."
She lowered her voice.
And I don't have to be much of a fortune teller to say that pretty soon I'm going to have to take it all over. And everyone knows this is just a crazy business I'm in," she said more loudly. "No security, bankable today, a bum tomorrow. A person like me can't get so much out of herself if she thinks that next week, next month, next year, sometime, she's going to be on the sidewalk. Have some shrimp." "I have some shrimp."
"Have some more shrimp."
"I don't want any more shrimp," she said with annoyance.
Then she looked at him.
"Was that your sympathetic routine number 12?
"Number 9, actually. I wish you wouldn't see through me so quickly. It makes me blush."
"You've never blushed in your life."
"Why don't you try to tell me in some sort of narrative form, some sequence?"
"Can't. I'm just a simple journalist, temporarily out of work. The whole thing landed on me like a big bomb just a couple of weeks ago, just before I was due on location for Midsummer Night's Madness. Hell of a way to start a picture, looking drawn and haggard."
"You've never looked drawn and haggard in your life."
He looked at the lights in her tanned blonde skin, the lights in her blonde hair.
"Ashes and honey don't mix."
"Okay," she said, "the story. A couple of weeks ago, I get a call from a man at the Internal Revenue Service who says he's very sorry to bother me, but..."
With them, it's the but that counts.
"Right away, I told him to call Steve Peterman, that Steve Peterman takes care of all my business affairs, taxes, etc., etc. And he said that was why he was calling me personally, because maybe Mr. Peterman hadn't told me that if I didn't do something within a matter of days, I was going to jail. Me going to jail, not Steve Peterman."
"Oh, Moxie, the Internal Revenue Service always talks tough.
I once had a very funny experience. Right now, Fletch, I'm not interested in the comic side of the Internal Revenue Service." I asked the man what he was talking about. He said I'd gone way beyond my last extension and a lot of other things I didn't understand. I asked him to slow down and speak in a language I could understand.
"That's asking a bit too much of any government."
"Well, he did. He was really very kind. I sort of understood him after a while. Instead of paying my taxes over the last years, Steve has been asking for extensions, so I'm years behind. I asked the man how much I owe. He said they don't know. They think it's a considerable whack of money. But then he said something or other about all the money I've had going in and out of the country makes things rather confusing."
"What money have you had going in and out of the country?"
"I have no idea."
"Into the country, I understand, maybe. Being in the film business, you probably have some foreign income. Out of the country, I don't understand. Do you have any investments abroad?"
"Not that I know of. Why should I?"
"Well, it's possible Steve had you invested in French perfumery or something."
"He never mentioned it. You haven't heard the worst. I was greatly upset. I called Steve, and that made me more upset. He was distinctly dodgy, Fletch, on the telephone. He said, 'Not to worry, not to worry. I was about to start principal photography on the film, and I should keep my mind on that. He'd take care of everything else.' I was so upset I screened 'Being There' 3 times and 'Why Shoot the Teacher' 2 times.
"Say, you were upset."
"I called Steve back and told him I was taking the next plane to New York. He squawked and gobbled. By the time I got to the apartment in New York and called him, he'd been called away to Atlanta, Georgia, on business."
"While we're speaking of that, Moxie..." Her eyes widened at the interruption.
"You do live pretty well,"
Fletch said. "You have that big place in Malibu on the beach with a pool and screening room. You have that real nice apartment in New York."
"Look who's talking," she exclaimed. "A two-bit reporter with a gorgeous place on the Italian Riviera."
"Oh, that again."
"Who spent years on a book about some artist."
"Edgar Arthur Tharp."
She grinned wickedly. "How's the book coming, Fletch?"
"Slowly."
"Slowly? Have you started chapter 2 yet?"
"There have been a lot of distractions."
"I need the house in California, Fletch, for my work. I live there. I need the apartment in New York. For my work, I live there. Neither place is a Sun and Sport Palaccia in Italy."
"Well, I've had my troubles with the Internal Revenue Service, too."
"No more of your sympathy, thank you. I do believe the Internal Revenue Service in this case is right. In New York, I go over to Steve's office, even though I've been told he's not there. Everybody recognizes me, of course. They've been dealing with my stuff for years. I request a quiet office and all the books, all the figures which relate to me and my affairs.
They had to give them to you.
They did.
But why did you ask?
Why not? I had to. Moxie, there's no way you can understand such books and figures, as you call them, without training. You needed a professional accountant.
I could understand enough.
You could understand nothing.
For years, Steve has been telling me I must borrow money, I must borrow money. Being in debt was good for me. Paying interest greatly improved my tax situation. I hated the whole thought of being in debt. He explained to me it was just paper debt. So every time he shoved papers in front of me, I signed them. Fletch, I discovered that he had borrowed millions of dollars in my name.
Entirely possible. Probably right, I think. I don't know either.
Fletch, what's a tax shelter?
It's a little stick house where you go to live once the Internal Revenue Service is done with you.
He had borrowed money in my name from foreign banks, Geneva, Paris, Mexico City.
That seems odd. I really don't know.
He bought stock with my money, all of which seemed to diminish rapidly in value.
Bad luck.
Real estate in Atlantic City. A horse farm somewhere. Film companies.
Moxie, the figures mean nothing to you. They wouldn't mean anything to me either. The way these business types do up their figures is meant to baffle all normal human beings.
Fletch, she said like a scared child, I am millions of dollars in debt to the banks, to the Internal Revenue Service.
She turned her chair and looked out the window. Fletch gave her the moment of silence. Frederick Mooney had opened another bottle from his flight bag and had poured into a champagne glass.
Oh, look, Moxie said finally. The moon is rising.
It is, Fletch said.
Perfect timing.
He leaned forward to look through the window. The moon really was rising.
Ah, very romantic of me.
Right in the right spot in my window, too, she said. Mr. Fletcher, are you trying to seduce me?
No, you're too drawn and haggard.
She shrugged. It's always the ones I'm attracted to who won't have me.
After a while, Fletch asked,
What did Steve Peterman say when you confronted him with all this?
Just what you said. That I didn't know what I was talking about. Everything was too complicated for me to understand. That after principal photography of the film was over, he'd go over the books with me and explain everything.
And the Internal Revenue Service?
He said he'd take care of that.
And you left everything that way?
I spent a week trying to find you. I asked you to come down.
I'm not an accountant. I wish I were. I see three figures together and suffer vertigo.
I needed a shoulder to cry on.
I've got two of them.
Also, Fletch, I hate to speak well of you to your face, but you did have one or two successes as an investigative reporter.
Only recognized as such in retrospect, I fear.
You've told me a few things you've done.
Anything to while away the time.
I thought maybe I'd get your opinion of Steve Peterman.
He was an annoying son of a bitch.
Frederick Mooney swiveled around in his chair to face them.
How could I have been seeing Broadway? He asked.
That's a good question, Fletch answered.
We've been flying over Broadway, Frederick Mooney told his daughter. The Great White Way, the star-spangled street, the magnificent road of light in an ocean of darkness.
Oh, Fletch said, we've been flying over the Florida Keys.
Well, young man, Frederick Mooney burped, I suspect we're about to land on Herald Square.
Chapter 9.
Fletch, what have you done?
What do you mean, what have I done?
In the dark, Moxie was squinting at the airport where they had landed.
Where are we?
Here.
We're not in Fort Myers.
We aren't.
He was trying to hustle Moxie and Frederick Mooney from the airplane to the taxi stand. Unfortunately, there were signs in all the appropriate places saying Key West.
We're in Key West, Moxie said.
We are.
Fletch took Mooney's clanging flight bag from him.
Darn pilot must have landed us in the wrong place.
Union Square? Inquired Mooney.
What are we doing in Key West?
Fletch was walking them around the terminal rather than through it.
You said you were tired of Route 41.
So?
All roads end in Key West, usually in a pileup. There were two taxis at the stand.
"Fletch," Moxie said seriously, "that woman, the chief of detectives, she told us not to leave the Fort Myers area. At least she told me not to leave the Fort Myers area."
"She mentioned something of the same to me, too." Moxie faced Fletch on the sidewalk.
"Then what are we doing in Key West?"
"Escaping."
"We were told..."
"That has no force in law, you know."
"It hasn't."
"No, it hasn't. We're not out on bail or on parole. We haven't been charged with anything."
Frederick Mooney was climbing into the back seat of a taxi. "Are we fugitives from justice?" she asked.
"Ah, that we may be. It's just that if you run away under such circumstances, people are more apt to think you're guilty."
"And we've run away. Great!"
"Well, hell, Moxie, aren't you guilty?"
Her eyes went from him to the patient taxi driver to Mooney's dark bulk in the back seat.
"Not too many people had the opportunity, given the unique circumstances which then prevailed of sticking old Steve."
"Up there," Fletch pointed to the sky, "you gave heavy enough reasons for killing him to bring the airplane down anywhere."
"Opportunity," Fletch said.
"Motive," Fletch said.
"You mean I shouldn't have told you all that?"
"Justification," Fletch said. "Sounded a millimeter away from a confession to me."
For a moment under the arc lights, Moxie Mooney almost looked drawn and haggard.
"Come on," Fletch said. "Let's go with Freddy. Otherwise, he might not know where he's going."
Moxie sat between them in the back seat of the taxi. "The Blue House," Fletch said to the driver, "on Duval Street." The taxi started off. To Moxie, Fletch said, "I borrowed a house from a friend."
Mooney took a drink.
"Listen," Fletch said to Moxie, "a few days of peace and quiet."
Moxie got out of the taxi while Fletch was paying the driver through the side window. She looked up at the lit house.
"Irwin," she said, "this blue house is not blue."
"It isn't?"
"Am I going crazy? Even in this light, I can tell this blue house is not blue."
Fletch helped Frederick Mooney out of the taxi.
"Key West is an eccentric town," Fletch said. "Doubt you'll be here long enough to get used to it."
Moxie hesitated on the sidewalk. She raised her head and spoke to the sky.
"What am I supposed to do?"
"Be nice," Fletch answered, helping Mooney up the three steps.
"Mr. Peterson," Mooney said at the top of the stairs, "you are a nice young man, but if you don't stop helping me, I will brain you."
"Sorry." Fletch let go of him. Mooney swayed on the veranda.
"You're upsetting my balance."
Moxie followed them through the doorway.
"Why is this blue house white?"
"Geez," Fletch said. "You couldn't call it the White House. Wouldn't be respectful."
The Lopezes, who took care of the blue house, were not in the house. Fletch knew they lived in their own house behind the garden wall. The front door had been left unlocked, the lights on. In the dining room, a tray of cut sandwiches had been set out along with a fancy ice bucket full of cans of beer. Lights were on even at the back of the house in the billiard room. Fletch zipped around the house, turning out the lights.
"I'll show you to your rooms."
Moxie said, "It's not even 9 o'clock.
"Time means nothing in Key West."
He started up the stairs.
"Never believe a clock in Key West."
Mooney attacked the stairs.
"Charge!" he said.
Plodding after him, Moxie said, "Dear O.L., your allusion to arsenic and old lace under these circumstances is decidedly in poor taste." Fletch pointed to the first door on the right. "This is your room, Ms. Mooney. I think you'll find everything in order. Towels in the bathroom." She looked into the room and then across the wide corridor at him. "Do I give you a tip?"
"If you have trouble with the air conditioner, just call downstairs."
Fletch pushed open another door.
"This room is yours, Mr. Mooney. See, nice big double bed."
"Very good."
Frederick Mooney staggered through the door to his room.
"What time do I go on?"
"Not to worry," Fletch said. "We'll call you in plenty of time."
"Just did Lear," Fletch heard Mooney muttering through the door. "Must be Richard III tonight."
Moxie was standing in the doorway. Even in her black dress, even standing still, her chin tilted slightly up, the light behind her made her presence, her being, exciting. "Good night, Ms. Mooney. Sleep well."
"Good night," she said,
Thanks for bringing my luggage, Fletch said. I didn't, did I? In his own room, Fletch walked out of his moccasins, dropped his shirt and his shorts and his undershorts in a heap on the floor, walked through a warm shower in no time at all, and then walked into bed, fell down, and pulled the sheet over him. Then he laughed. Chapter 10. I can hardly wait to get old. On the bed, Moxie ran her legs down his and stretched. Wrinkled and baggy. That's what we all want for you, Fletch said. I don't mean old, Moxie said. Just old enough to have an excuse to get fat and ugly. Can hardly wait for the day. She rolled onto her side and faced him, as he was on his side, and their naked bodies were together all the way up and down, except for their stomachs. I can hardly wait to get some rolls with some real character in them. Belly rolls, huh? Married women, mothers, nuns, grandmothers, business executives, you know what I mean. Women who've lived a little, have some dimension to them, and it shows in their faces. The long door windows were open to the second floor balcony, and the breeze coming in was slightly humid over their slightly sweaty bodies. Being Moxie, she had come into his room naked and walked around the room slowly, turning on every light. Her body was totally tanned, as it had to be for her role in Midsummer Night's Madness. She had jumped onto his bed, reached down and torn the sheet off him, and then fell on him, flat, jumping to as great a height as she could manage to do so. Which is why Fletch had turned on his side, and they had come to embrace in that position. Not like this damned role in Midsummer Night's Madness. You know how the scriptwriter wrote in the character for my role? I quote, beautiful blonde female, American build, in 20s, dash Moxie Mooney, unquote. You sound a natural for the role. You call that writing character? Well, you're beautiful and you're blonde all the way up and down, and you're female all the way up and down. What's an American build? Guess you're looking at it, baby. I'm not seeing anything but your eyes, forehead, nose, and cheekbones. You're feeling it, aren't you? Oh, yes, I'm feeling it. Feel it some more, she said. Wait a minute. No, let's not. Then he was on his back, and the breeze seemed cooler to him. There are good roles for young people, he said. There must be. Not in Midsummer Night's Madness. In Midsummer Night's Madness, I am body pure and simple, wide-eyed, innocent, staring, and stupid. All I do is say, oh, and look alarmed. There are more O's in that script than in 10 kilos of Swiss cheese. Must be tough, being just another beautiful face, a body. Each was spread-eagled on the huge bed, cooling off. Only the tips of their fingers touched. Knock it off, Fletcher. I was brought up trained to do more than stand there and say, oh. Freddy and I saw to that. I'm not giving you talk show interview motif number one. Sounds it. For a long moment, she looked at the ceiling. Then she said, I guess I am. Oh, dear. First time you've ever called me dear. I didn't call you dear. I called the ceiling dear. Watch those expressions of affection, Moxie. Remember, I'm going to have to write to you in the slammer, and our mail will be censored. What I'm saying is all this trouble over this film, and the film stinks. Wooden scenes, turgid dialogue, stereotyped characters. All it really is about is people chasing each other along a moonlit beach at night and whumping each other. Should be a hit. Starring Moxie Mooney and Jerry Littleford. And Jerry Littleford. Not up to his talents either. If this film is so bad, Moxie, dear, why are you doing it? Steve said I had to. Fulfill some contract or other. Fulfill some contract you signed? I signed, or he signed. Seems to me you handed over a large slice of your life to Steve Peterman. Fletch, a person in my shoes has to trust somebody. You're not wearing shoes, I noticed. One cannot be 100% creative sharp and 100% business sharp at the same time. It is mentally and physically impossible. Some people pick wonderful business managers in the talent garden and live happily ever after. I picked a bad apple. And if the district attorney don't get you, the IRS will. You make everything sound so cheery. Everything is cheery. It's all in the point of view. Want me to tell you about this dumb movie? Yeah, tell me a story. Girl, got it so far? Yeah, American build. I can see her now. Small town. Anywhere USA. Anywhere. Gets raped by son of chief of police.
Opening scene. Opening scene.
Beats the aerial view of the Empire State Building.
Of course she doesn't tell.
Why not?
Girls frequently don't tell when they've been raped, Mr. Fletcher.
Why not?
It embarrasses them, Moxie said uncomfortably. It's the psychology of the whole thing. For some crazy reason, they think it lowers them in the esteem of others.
Does it?
You tell me, does it?
I hate the whole thought.
Have you been raped? She asked.
Sure.
Have you told?
No.
Why not?
Well, it comes up in conversation so seldom, he said.
You're not letting me get to the point of the movie.
Get to the point.
Girl is pregnant. Girl is truly in love with young black male.
American build?
You've seen Jerry Littleford.
Handsome man, looks like a greyhound. Racing dog, I mean, not the bus.
White girl and black man get engaged to be married.
Does he know she's pregnant by another man?
Sure, these people really love each other.
And what happens?
Town finds out they intend to get married.
Town not pleased. Give black man a hard time. Town discovers girl is pregnant already. And then on Midsummer's night, town goes crazy and pursues black man through countryside, swamp, woods, until he comes to the edge of the ocean, where they catch him and beat him to death.
Needless to say, rapist son of police chief deals the killing blow right into the black man's head while the black man's head is against a rock.
Yuck.
Midsummer night's madness.
It plays upon people's worst emotions, Moxie. It really does.
Oh, come on, Fletch. People don't think that way anymore. Jerry Littleford's wife is white.
Yeah, in recent years, miscegenation has been made legal, most places.
You mean it's still illegal in some places?
Yes.
Come on, Fletch. I've read there's no such thing as an American black person without some white blood.
We're talking about rape again, aren't we?
Fletch sat up on the bed and put his back against the tall carved wooden backboard. I wasn't even thinking of those things.
Moxie rolled over and put her chin in her elbow.
I just think as a movie it stinks. It's badly written. I think the whole thing was written between drinks in the polo lounge by people who don't know anything about boys and girls, men and women, human beings, the South, the North, or America. The world. Scene for scene, it just doesn't reflect how people regard each other.
Moxie,
I'm still here in case you hadn't noticed.
I'm just thinking. The hit and run. Peterman. A question some reporter asked at the police station.
Is it possible someone or some group is trying to stop this film from being made?
Her one visible eye looked up and down the wrinkled sheet between them.
No.
Why not?
Commit murder to stop a film?
I suppose it's possible.
People are more sophisticated than that.
She curved her back and leaned on her elbows.
It's a bad film, Fletch. It will never be released. No one will ever see it.
Yeah, but no one knows that yet.
I'll tell them if they ask me.
You will like hell. In fact, let me ask you this. If filming resumes on this turkey film, will you go back on location and continue starring in it?
I have to, Fletch. I have no choice.
Thanks to dear old Steve Peterman.
Thanks to dear old Steve Peterman, she repeated quietly.
Somewhere in the house a door slammed. A heavy door.
What was that?
She asked.
Oh, no,
Fletch said. He jumped off the bed.
Oh, no.
He ran down the stairs and opened the front door of the house and stepped out onto the porch. He looked down toward the center of Key West. There was no one in the street except two men walking directly in front of the house.
Come on all the way out, beautiful, called one man.
You're gorgeous, screamed the other one.
The first one belted the second one hard. Fletch heard a bottle drop. He realized he was naked.
Sorry, he said.
He went back in the house and closed the door. Looked in the kitchen. Upstairs, he looked in Frederick Mooney's room. Returning to his own bedroom, he said, I guess your father went out for a walk.